Mr. James Reel 34. So, the role of headquarters company in action, could you just right. describe what the setup was
so
in terms of.
He said, we were set up our headquarters as an archway going through a street of houses. And these houses must have been the back end of the houses because they had back doors going down some steps into their gardens. And the houses were in front. So we must go through the end of these houses, you see. And there was an archway, and that was our company headquarters. And in the building we needed from there, we set up our centre. And we had, because it was so chaotic, and the enemy was filtering through and counterattacking and coming through the gardens, everybody took positions in bedrooms of these houses. And we occupied maybe 8 or 9 of these houses and we up in the bedrooms with blends through the windows, waiting for the infiltrators to come and show themselves. And I, coming to my second, he said, don't be so much bloody noise, our major. He said, we've had mortars all around us all day. He says, and if the enemy is not far away, he says, if they hear you, they are there. He said, we could have better stop him. He said, be a bit quiet. He said, I've just been down, he said, the 6th door down to do a crap. And I was disturbed, he says, I think it was the enemy, he said, a machine gun crew. So he said, I've left my belt and pouches and revolver on the garden. And I beat a hasty retreat. Will you go down and please try and recover my equipment? I said, what's that like? I said, you've done a crap. I said, you run back and you want me to go get your bloody revolver? I said, that's a joke. He said, please go down and try and retrieve my revolver. I said, the 6th floor down. He said, yes, it is the 6th floor down, he says. So I went down with my Tommy gun. And I knew it didn't meet any eventuality. And I went down into the garden. I saw his crap, and I saw his revolver and his equipment, and I picked it up. And I came back up the steps. I went back to him. He said, thank you very much for that. I gave him his revolver, and I said, come on, you know, I guess, sir. I said, it's too bloody dangerous. So I said, I'm going now. I said, I've seen the colonel is along here. I said, I'm going to up in the bedrooms to see how the lads are doing. He said, right. So I went down, and about the 5th door down, I went down and where CQMS Day was standing at the back of the house, outside, all alone, in the garden, with a Tommy gun. And I came around the corner, and he thought I was a jelly. And he fired off. I stopped just in time. He said, God. He said, I thought you were a German. He said, you're the luckiest bloke alive, I'm telling you now. Well, I said, you're bloody trigger happy, aren't you? He said, well, they're everywhere, aren't they? I said, yeah, they are. I said, where's the colonel? He says, upstairs.
So he actually fired at you. He fired at you.
He fired. He was slipping, and he stopped in time. And he stopped a yard or feet from me, you know. And I just froze there. And I was too bloody dumb. Could he say, sir, it's me? The bloke was blind. Anyway, upstairs I went. I think it was day 2. And there was quite a person in the bedroom. And the bloke's on the bed, to the branch of the window. And the enemy was filtering through. And he was trying to fire short bursts. And at the same time as Hospital Hill, where Captain Duffy was, and Major Duffy was at Hospital Hill, and Viz with his lot on Hospital Hill, there's a little feature nearby called Hospital Hill.
So in what relationship was Hospital Hill to where you were in terms of...
Not very far away. Just along, further down there, at Hospital Hill.
To the left of where you were.
To the left, that's right. And so we were all defending and firing at anything that we saw.
So how would Colonel Preston fight the battalion, as it were? HQ company. How would it work? The mechanics of it.
You're in
a HQ company.
Yeah.
This is your base of operations. What was actually going on at HQ?
I didn't know where the captain headquarters were.
So they were
nearby.
So they were somewhere else apart
absolutely
from HQ
nearby.
Company.
Nearby. We were all, as one unit now, defending this part. And we were defending this sector as headquarter company. There we were. And we were absolutely firing at anything that moved because it was general chaotic infiltration by the enemy. We turned our backs, all the civilian population gone. There was an ambulance behind us. It was now getting dark, on fire. A mortar bomb or two would hit it, and the ambulance was burning furiously in the road. And personnel had run away from it. There was nobody in it, but it was on fire. And this ambulance is a vivid memory of mine, is behind us in this road, blazing away. And across the road, with all the civilian population evacuated, out came a bloke dressed in a long black coat and a black derby hat. And I said to the company commander, I said, that's a bloody Jerry. He said, shoot the bugger there. And I shot him. And I went over, and it was a German officer dressed up in bloody civilian clothes, moving rapidly, and there he was down. And that was a scene. And I've never forgotten that burning ambulance, this black figure, moving at fast, thinking he'd fought us. That he was with it, all the military was evacuated and was right over there.
And
he was a German officer.
And was that with the Tommy gun, your Tommy gun?
I shot him with a little Tommy gun. I met him under him.
What actually happened after that? I mean, did you search for documents and so on?
We had so many mortar bombs dropped near to us that one dropped very, very close to me. And although I'd had my ear damage and such an area, the blast eventually made it separate. Well, I wasn't aware of the meaning of this separation. I didn't realize. But I was discharged from the ear, and it was that mortar bomb that did it.
And when was this? The mortar bomb?
Day two. So I didn't say it to the commander, because after all, it was pouring out like custard from my ear, and it got worse and worse. I was pouring down my right ear, down to my neck, and down, and it kept on discharging. And layer upon layer and layer, we didn't bark, we didn't shave anything, and discharging the air I've got. I didn't even tell the commander. Now, he must have been able to see me and look at me day after day, because on day 11, the adjutant came around and he said, we're pulling out in a half an hour. You know, I said, yes, sir. I said, we bring orders. He said, what the hell is the matter with your ear? I said, well, this was blasted at such an aim that I said, more than one of this on day two. He says, you like that? He says, it's day two. It is now about day 11, day 10 or 11. I said, yes, sir. He says, you must be in agony. I said, I am. I'm telling you. He said, I order you now. He said, where's Captain Sunso? I said, gone to a CEO's meeting to receive instructions about pulling out. I said, but that's already pulled out. He said, you go now, down to the CCS, it's down that road down there. He says, and it's on the left. Go down now, and he said, you'll be on that hospital ship. I said, I don't want to go, sir, because I've seen a hospital ship being run down on the whatnot. I said, I'd rather stay here for the night as well. He said, there's no hospitals here, there's no anything here, there's no treatment here. We can't do anything for you. He says, I'm giving him orders now. So I said, you're down to the CCS, and I'll stay here in your position until Captain Derrick comes back. And I'll tell him what I've done. He said, go on. Bloody fool, it's part of your brain. That's what he said, part of his shot. And he gave him a salute and a smile, and I walked down to the CCS. And clearly not. He went in there, and there was all sorts of work there. And the American Rangers, the first time I'd seen Americans, American Rangers in the CCS, one girl went bump, 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 four bullets down his chest there, and he's still alive. And they brought him in from where he was. I still found where he was. He was still our left. I've since learned where they were in action, on our left. And there was an Italian man with a very badly wounded leg. He was gangrene, and his wife was giving him a drink from a dirty green, milk stained bottle. And he could smell the milk was off. And I still hadn't seen the officer in charge of the CCS. And she looked at me and she said, no, I didn't understand what she was saying, but she said, baby, do you want a drink? I said, that enough. Oh no, I couldn't sign it. And there's this Italian girl with his leg, black, dead, gangrenous, stinking. Eventually, this officer takes him, hello. What are you here, Farager? I said, well, my adjutant, sir. I said, St. James of the Devonhead Infantry. I said, Captain Pritchard, my adjutant, has just ordered me to come to see you about this. He said, can't do a thing for that. He said, we've got a blasted eardrum, perforated, separation, noise induced, label on there, hospital ship. Can't do a thing for you. You can notice that it is there. He said, what are you doing? We're pushing everybody on that ship. He says, the ship is out there half a mile, and the lifeboat's coming in and ferrying up the wounded. And he says, you're going to be walking wounded on the next boat that comes to the ship. He says, label on there, evacuation. He says, you'll be going to an American hospital somewhere. I said, right, sir. He said, all you've got to do is stay here until you get the orders to get on the next boat coming in to fill up. He says, at least that's here to be going on as well. And it happened. The next lifeboat came in, and I was evacuated on the ship and put on the hospital ship, where this wonderful Red Cross nurse, an elderly woman about 6 foot 4, saw me and was to say for about 11 days, something like that. She must have seen the haggard appearance of all of us, and she tapped me on the shoulder and said, "I can sell it for you." And she gave me a blue linen bag with Red Cross on it, full of goodies. Razor, soap, cigarettes, and everything I wanted. And she said, good, have a rest and a good sleep. She said, I'll call you and we watch you. The ship will be sailing very soon.
Now, before we talk about your treatment and so on at the hands of the Americans, just going back to the landing at Salerno and the role of the headquarters company.
Yeah.
What was the role of headquarters, or the different components of headquarters company?
That's right.
What were the different platoons supposed to do in action?
We would have operated as a cohesive battalion in normal circumstances, well organized in a field of battle, with the headquarters company office established very near to battalion headquarters. And we would be the nerve center for the various platoon commanders as well. The signals would be established at the headquarters, and then would be part of headquarters companies, telecommunications center as well. But the signalers would have been out of companies, the various platoons deployed.
What are the sections of headquarters company would there be? With intelligence section?
There was the intelligence section, the adjutant, the CEO was very busy. He was out and about conducting, visiting the companies. And we would have had our battle orders in a known situation with an objective to meet. There was no objective.
So
we had to go and we had to fight what we saw.
So in terms of what you'd been trained for, how a headquarters company worked, and what you were actually faced with at Salerno,
It was being in at the deep end, and we were wishing as well.
So your training actually fit the case for Salerno. You didn't get a chance to operate.
We were hoping that we would eventually get a beachhead established where there'd be sufficient of the British Army deployed in a proper manner to defend or attack the sector. But what we were doing, we were establishing a beachhead. And the beachhead wasn't really an ongoing thing for certain until about day 11 or something like that, because the Yanks were going to pull out. But eventually, we were visited by General Hawksworth, who was the division commander, and he saw us and he said, "Well done, the Durhams." He said, "Now," he said, "you've established the beachhead. Every step you take now is a step nearer home." And he had this long crook staff thing, like a shepherd's crook, that was about 8 foot high. and he was General Hawksworth.
And you remember when he visited?
That was when we knew that we had gained a beachhead, definitely. And that was the initial chaos. The initial battle was establishing a beachhead and fighting, shooting, whoever you saw.
Do you think that Colonel Preston had effective control of the battalion at this stage?
Yes. He was,
if he was back,
he was a man who exuded confidence. He was a dapper. He wasn't tall. He was a dapper little man with a military moustache and a kind face. I think he was a very understanding and well-liked chap, bearing in mind that he was a KYLI man, and he had taken over from Dickie Ware. And he was new to us, and we were new to him. He was a super CEO, and he knew exactly what he was doing. And as I said, he was silent, efficient. He knew what he was going to do next, and we thought that we were lucky to have him.
So, at this stage, there was also the big battle for Hospital Hill. How did news of that filter back?
Well, we knew that Hospital Hill was a battle involving the Durham companies. Captain Duffy, or I don't know where the name of the captain, we soon found out, captured his position. He did a bayonet attack. His company attacked the bayonets, and he got the MC for it. And there were many other chaps who had the war there. So in his sector, and this as well, was on the Hospital Hill.
That's made of his own.
But I mean, we didn't know who exactly, but Hospital Hill was the part, eventually, that was an important part of the battle for the Durhams.
And
there was a major chance there.
At this stage, were there many casualties in HQ Company over this period?
We had our quota of casualties. I think that we committed ourselves very well to Salerno. Yes, we had our casualties. They weren't very heavy. They were the usual quota. I would think that it wasn't a disaster. It was a jolly good battle. One of our battle honours. We did well there. Salerno is one of our battle honours. I'm very proud of that because that is one of the epics of World War II.
So, you told me off the tape when you were evacuated, you were aware of other British troops on the beach. Could you talk a little bit about that?
When we were in action, we were told that there was a crisis, but not with us. There was a crisis with the Americans, were on our right. Below the 56th Division. On our right with the 56th Division, they were at Batipaglia. Fighting in the sector on our right immediately. So there were two British divisions side by side, you know, and we were dealing with what we had. But below the 56th Division, on their right, were the Americans at Paestum. And then they were very nearly pushed back into the sea because Hitler gave orders that the American Foundation was called and wasn't to be allowed to land. And they really did the American Army. We, as British soldiers, were listening to the London News on the radio, and they never mentioned us at all. They never mentioned the British at all. It was the Americans that said that, the American Army, and we were indignant about it. And at that time, apart from the LCIs, we hadn't seen any American troops. I saw that great job badly wounded at the CCS. And they appeared to be on our extreme left, on the territory very near to Amalfi. So we said, American Army? Well, they were the British. And we established our quartet, our beachhead, and if it wasn't for us, Salerno would have been a rout and a disaster for the Americans. Mark Clark said, Churchill says soft underbelly Europe is a tough old gut. But it was a hell of a battle.
But you mentioned off the tape that there was this awareness of the so-called mutiny. Were you aware of that at the time, or did that come later?
So, we apparently were told there was a crisis and that the Americans were thinking about evacuation. The cry had gone out from Mark Clark for urgent reinforcements because it was a desperate, dangerous situation. So, this cry for help was heeded by even the British authorities, who took action and went immediately to all the North African sort of recuperation centres, where there were troops, ex-hospital, of Monty's Army and the First Army, who had been in the hospital and been wounded in North Africa, Tunisia, and the Viet Army, and they emptied all the convalescent centers of troops who appeared to be good enough and fit enough for battle. And they put them on destroyers, some of them unarmed, and told them they were going to rejoin their old units. They knew that their old units had gone home to the UK for the Second Front. Some of those were men of the 6th, 8th, and 9th DLI of the 8th Army. And well, there wasn't a crisis for us as the 16th Battalion in Salerno, but we were told that there were reinforcements of the DLI from the 6th, 8th, and 9th brought over by destroyer from either Tripoli or somewhere like that, or Libya or somewhere like that, and were on the beach.
And you were aware of this at the time?
We were told about it. And that they were, they refused to fight. And so they were in a pen on the beach. And they were being persuaded to rejoin the battalion. Although there was no crisis for us. In fact, by now the crisis for the whole of Salerno had been over at this particular time. Bearing in mind it was the 9th of September when we landed there. And now it is about the 20th or something like that, the 27th or something like that. And the crisis is over. There was no longer a crisis. But the Americans have shouted this alarm, and so all these police boys brought over, together with Scottish soldiers as well, 48th Army. But anyway, apparently, Colonel Preston was aware of these devils down on the beach, who wouldn't move. their sergeants told them that their officers said, refuse to fight with any other unit, demand to go back to your own units. And they were obeying that to the letter. So the test went down, apparently, to see them and to persuade them to prevent trouble. The big wigs of the war office now were sort of trumping up charges of all sorts. He persuaded them to join the battalion to avoid trouble. And they didn't heed his advice.
Were you aware of this at the time?
Aware,
when did you read about this?
We were aware of it vaguely, and I was aware that they were there.
And you did people talk about the fact that
they were talking about it? No, we didn't castigate. We thought, well, you know, the poor their units had got over to the UK. They brought them over to join us, and they were told they were going to join their units, and they'd be checked. We were aware of this, but we ourselves at this time. One infantryman knows another. We didn't blame them at all, really. We felt sorry for their predicament, to be honest with you. But we were aware of it, and we thought, well, we don't need them. They haven't been dashed down. We haven't suffered because of that. We have not.
Were you aware of any reinforcements coming through at this stage?
No. We weren't having any reinforcements at all.
So the reinforcements...
It was too early for that.
So the reinforcements had actually come...
Later.
For the men that were wounded and so on. Yeah.
The reinforcements came. Whenever the reinforcements came, I went into the American hospital. I was whipped across by this hospital ship, St. David. Eventually, we settled sail. And I was in the 103rd American General Hospital back in North Africa, in Tunisia, not very far from Bizerta. That was the nearest hospital for the Battle of Savannah for the Americans. Because and the hospital ship, St. David, the British hospital ship, was one of the hospital ships, one of them, bringing back British and American wounded. When we landed at Bizerta, we were met by hundreds of American ambulances. I was a war casualty. We were seen by doctors, and we were told we were going to be transported to this MASH open air, it was Canvas Hospital, in a place near Mateur, Mateur, a very far from Minnesota, inland. And so it was a sprawling American hospital, but it was hidden.
Just before we get to that, could you talk about your voyage aboard the hospital ship? You said it was a British hospital ship.
That's right.
What were the conditions like aboard that, and what do you remember about the hospital ship?
It was a hospital ship converted from a ship that used to be a ferry boat from North Wales to Ireland. And when the war started, they commandeered this ferry boat and transformed it into a hospital ship. And they called it the St. David, which was, I think, the name of the ship plying from North Wales anyway to Ireland. And it was painted white, and we had large red cross across the port starboard. And brightly lit at night, lights everywhere, hospital ship.
And how many casualties were aboard, do you think, at the time you were there?
It was chocker. It was absolutely chocker. I was one of the last get on it. It had been loaded for...
So would that be hundreds or thousands or...?
Hundreds. It wasn't a very large hundreds of casualties. Looking at the ambulances that arrived, the American ambulances at the quayside, went back out to... I couldn't assess how many there were. There were hundreds of ambulances.
And were the casualties British and American? Were they all mixed?
Yes. So that they had on this hospital ship, the American Rangers as well, were in action at the place called Mori, M-O-R-I, which is near to the left of Salerno. And that's where the Yanks were in action. They were American commandos, and I didn't know it at the time, but that's where they were. And they were the grand old British commanders to our left.